Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And just to recap about love letters are for anyone at any time, for any reason whatsoever, that you might have something you want to put to paper and mail to somebody to make somebody else's life richer. It is always a gift, custom designed for one person. As a rule, we might find out different actually today. And I'm going to go to our guest today, Lena Misitsis, who is a new friend of mine and said something to me that I found so charming that I asked her to come do a Love Letters with me. So I'm going to go right to you. Just talk about you and where you were born. And I know that your last name is Greek. And so I'm curious what that heritage, how that had an effect on your life and growing up and your family. Were your parents actually born in Greece?
Oh, yeah. So my parents immigrated to America in the late 70s. And I was born about 10 years after they moved to America.
Are you an only?
I am a second child.
Okay.
So my brother was born in 82 and I was born in 88. And so I was born in Virginia, which is already a very full and pregnant place to be from.
Because
the incredible history, the very tortured history. I just went and saw a movie, 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, yes.
Which is you know, fabulous movie
yes.
to watch. It's very, very hard to get through. And I was sitting in the theater watching it and thinking, it's so weird watching this from California because I am from the South, except for that when I want to feel divorced from the South, I do because I'm also from Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very strange being from a Mediterranean country growing up in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And that just getting to that movie for a minute, that was so disturbing.
Yeah.
For so many reasons, but how did people think they could get away with treating human beings like that?
With treating you that way?
We still treat people horribly.
I know.
There's too much of that in the world. But
the really scary thing about that movie is that the premise is a learned person
yes.
of color is kidnapped from the North and brought to the South. And
right.
it's a very tragic story because you're watching it and thinking, well, it's extra not fair for him, even though there's no such thing as extra
not fair.
Did you
feel that?
Yeah.
It was extra ignorant of the people who did it in
right.
some way, but then not at all.
But then not
it's
at all.
It's just an incredibly ignorant thing. Yeah.
It's the same amount as, it's just the same
because
amount
the original
of
people who were kidnapped were educated in their country.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, well, let's go back to you. I know that was just so upsetting, that the concepts in it and that, yes. Okay, so growing up in Virginia, so what kind of ways of living did you learn growing up there? I mean, you talk about its tortured history, but...
Every field trip K through 12 was either to a plantation or to a battlefield.
In some historical positive way?
There was a positive spin. Like the younger you are, the less they tell you about what the problem is with where you're going.
But how do they explain plantations? I'm really interested in that.
This is where the slave quarters were. And this, the
end
words,
of sentence.
Right. And the word slave may not have meant very much to us as like 8 year olds. And
right.
then as we got older, we learned more. We went to Gettysburg. We went to Bull Run.
Uh-huh.
We went to all of the places where it all happened. But that's always the first difference I identify with my friends who are from the North or who are from the West, which is that my excursion experience as a child was very much based in this troubled history that is Virginia.
And was it presented to you as troubled history or just history?
No, because there's this incredible pride still in the South. And not that Northern Virginia is very much the South anymore.
Uh-huh.
It's the reason the state swings blue now in the elections is because of Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is we're still in that state.
Yes. And you don't have any South feel or sound to you.
No.
Did the people you were growing up with, or is that just...
Some did.
Linguistically different.
Depending on the parents. I mean, if anything, I
was going to ask you that, yeah.
If anything, I should have a tiny bit of an accent. Greek was my first language.
Uh-huh.
And there's some words that I've read on paper many times but have never said out loud because at home we mostly spoke Greek.
Oh.
So there is the occasional word that I say incorrectly, but otherwise...
Can you say what one would be?
A really obvious example from high school was... I don't remember the story at all, but there was a rocket ship that went down in Texas, and we were talking about the debris, but I kept calling it Debris in class.
Oh, because you just were pronouncing it as it. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's not an English word and it's not a Greek word.
Nope.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me how did your upbringing differ maybe from your friends just because of your cultural background? Or maybe it didn't.
Americans, my mother always said that when she moved to the country, what she noticed was that Americans talked much louder than Greeks did and from further away. So Greeks,
oh, yes.
Greeks are close talkers.
Yes.
Like our faces will get
yes.
very close to each
yes.
other.
That personal space is much different in Mediterranean countries. Exactly.
So she was, she calls it like white toast America. She's surprised by what's cold here, the way people are cold here and the way people talk louder. And people also talk to
me. Well, of course, if you're standing farther away, you have to talk louder.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And people have always talked to my mother like she's an immigrant. So, and usually they just misunderstand and assume that she's Latina. So people will sometimes talk to her in Spanish.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
And I really, I haven't thought about this in forever, but when I was little, I used to be treated like translator when we would go to, like, the grocery store.
Oh, sure.
People would direct questions about, like, how, like, are you paying in cash or credit? They would ask me instead of my mom, because they assumed I was...
And your mother has an accent.
She has a thick
yes.
accent, yeah.
Of course, you know, some of the letters are pronounced the same as in Spanish.
Absolutely.
So that's not such a horrible thing, for a mistake for people to make.
No. Yes. In fact, it's a lot more... I don't know if the word sympathetic is right, but there's something very sweet about it. It's this attempt to connect. It's just very misguided.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. That's really a nice way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yes. So how long did you stay there? When did you leave and where did you go?
In Virginia?
Uh-huh.
I was in Virginia. I spent a lot of time in Greece growing up, but when I turned...
No, what city in Greece?
Athens, mostly.
Oh, big town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Big time.
And my dad is... his family is from a small village in the southernmost point of the Peloponnesian... it's like the mainland, but it's the second island below the main island.
What is that?
It's the island is called Stupa. It's about 50 miles south of Kalamata.
So how did they meet?
My parents?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I love their story.
Oh, tell.
I think this is fine. My dad was dating a woman and he and his girlfriend went to a bar and my mom was at the same bar with a mutual friend of my father's.
But they were in such different... Oh, was he in Athens by that time?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
They were both in Athens.
Okay.
So he was at a bar with his girlfriend. My mom was at a bar with my father's friend. My dad told his girlfriend to go home because she was tired. And that night he kissed my mother for the first time.
Oh, my goodness.
And then they stayed together forever.
That's very simple and nice.
It's very simple
yeah,
and nice. Yeah,
that is direct. So when did you leave Virginia?
I was...
And why? And what were you like as a kid?
What was I like as a kid?
Yeah.
I had a hard time as a kid. I've always been very like opinionated, loud, sensitive, feel like I wear my feelings
mm-hmm.
very loudly. And my goal growing up was I just want to get out. Like I just want to get out. I want to meet people. I want to go places. And I didn't even apply to college in my last year of high school. And then at the last minute, the August after I graduated high school, I decided I wanted to go to college.
What were you thinking that you would do instead?
I was going to work at restaurants, and with that money, I was going to
mm-hmm.
make it work. I had,
okay.
I had no real plan.
It was kind of vague?
Yeah.
Yes, all right.
So at the very last minute, I applied to a university in Richmond, Virginia that had rolling admission.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there. So
rolling admission is you can just...
Apply anytime.
Yes, that's nice.
Yeah. And so I went to a great college in Richmond for 2 years. And while I was there, my goal was to do well enough that I would leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up in New York City, but I followed a boy there. So it's not even really this incredible, ambitious story. It's that my boyfriend at the time was going to Sarah Lawrence, and I decided I wanted to go to Sarah Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah Lawrence is a historically all women's school in Bronxville, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied, I was waitlisted, and then I applied to an art school in Brooklyn called Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into Pratt.
Good for you.
And I went to Pratt. And so I moved to New York when I was 20, and he and I broke up before I even got there.
what was your goal at Pratt? I mean, you must have quite a bit of talent to have gotten in, and what was your direction?
I'm a gifted writer.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. They do that also. Uh-huh. You are a gifted writer.
They have a
yes.
they have a creative writing program. It's called Writing for Media and Publication. So it's a very specific kind of writing. It's writing with the intention of it being on film, on radio, on television, or published.
When did you know you were a gifted writer?
That was kind of no secret. It's really funny how you sometimes are born with these things that you don't pay very much attention to.
Oh, your throwaway talents,
mm-hmm.
I call them. Yes. The things that are easy for you to do
right.
and seem like no big deal, and other people are just really agog.
Floored by them.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. They're like, you meet people with the kind of charisma that they can get out of any ticket, or they can charm any server into giving them free dessert, whatever it is. Like, you meet these people with incredible talents that they just don't register.
Yes. Or singing or drawing, or it goes everywhere. So what about yours?
So mine was always writing.
And how did you know? When did it surface?
So in my first 2 years of college in Richmond, I took a creative writing class, and schoolwork was something I didn't care very much about until that point. But the writing assignments I was always really excited about, because it's very practical. It's that I knew I was good at them, so I was really excited to do them, and I would spend hours and hours on my writing.
And do you like that kind of reporting writing best?
I like creative nonfiction, so I like telling true stories in as alternative a way as possible.
Oh, nice. So do you like those kind of historical fiction, like the Mary Renault books? I don't know if you've ever read those, but the Greek myths, for example, filled out and...
I'm trying to think of a really good famous example of what it is, and I think Joan Didion, topical, because she's from California, isn't she?
An example. Truman Capote also did that.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay, I see what you mean. I just wanted to kind of clarify it for...
David Sedaris does a great job of it.
Yes.
He's a trip. I knew that's what I was supposed to do, and so I found a school with a program for it.
Okay. And from there?
I went to Brooklyn.
And tell me about that. Because, okay, so this is where we kind of connected, so... When I was talking about how glad I was that you moved to San Francisco, because you're such a treat. And you said, well, it's not really where I want to be.
No.
I want to be in Brooklyn. And I'd never heard anybody here say they want to be someplace else, because I think there's a certain panache to say you want to be in San Francisco. So talk about that.
Sure. Well, I think I should fast forward through it, and then we can go back and talk about
it
slowly. But I spent 5 years in Brooklyn. And then I got a job that I just couldn't turn down in D.C. So I was in D.C. for 10 months. And when my time in D.C. I was writing for radio. And so when my time in D.C. was up, my options were either go back to Brooklyn, where at that point I knew and I still know I'm going to spend the rest of my life, or try something different first and then go back when you're ready. And so I decided to try out San Francisco, and you're absolutely right that people view San Francisco as the destination, not the pit stop. And I knew even getting on the plane to move here that this was just a thing I was trying out. And
so what made this be the thing you were trying out?
But everyone says you should live in California.
Oh, that's right. Yes, right. So the mythology of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's funny because I imagine when people say you should live in California once in your life, they don't mean this one microcosm of California that is San Francisco, because this is very different from the rest of the state. I imagine they mean you should live in Los Angeles once in your life,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think I'll do. I think that San Francisco is a very good choice, because in this city, there are flavors of tons and tons of other cities in San Francisco.
Sure.
And there is a version of Brooklyn here, too.
Okay, so go ahead. I want you to get back to Brooklyn.
So the big thing with New York was that when I was a kid, every year for my birthday, instead of having a party, my parents would take me to New York so I could see a musical.
Oh.
So I've been in love with the New York skyline, with the streets, with the theater, with the culture. It's been such a part of me for years and years and years. And when my parents actually moved me there when I was, I think I was 19 when I actually got out of the car and suddenly I lived in Brooklyn, it was not the New York that I had in mind. Because the New York you can afford when you're 19 is, like, I lived upstairs from a fried chicken restaurant. Restaurant's a funny choice of word. It was a bulletproof fried chicken, like, storefront window that I lived upstairs from. Across the street were three project buildings. Down the street there was a cemetery.
Now, did you live by yourself?
I lived with three young girls.
Oh, so you weren't with your parents. I mean, you moved at 19. Uh-huh.
They drove me up and dropped me off, and all of a sudden I was in what I now know to be like the actual New York,
mm-hmm.
and not the Woody Allen New York that you see in the movies. And that's the New York I fell in love with truly is the bulletproof glass projects across the street in New York.
Now, why? I mean, because what you said is I could write 1,000 love letters to Brooklyn.
Yeah, and they would all be different.
Why don't you just start one?
Start one.
Yeah. What would you talk about? What is most endearing? What makes it feel like home? And how important is that for your soul to be really at home?
It's really important to find a home. And some people have to find homes in their bodies, and other people have to find homes in space, and other people have to find homes in neighborhoods. Other people find homes in partners. Mm-hmm. And I think the real pull of New York for the people that live their whole lives there is that they have found a home in the geography. And
what goes into, is it just geography, or is it also pace and creativity? And
it's the landscape, it's the beat, it's the way there's four bridges that lead to the same place, and it seems like only one of them should have been built, but there's four. There's a lot of that city is unintentionally thrown together. And I was speaking with a woman who leads these boat tours of parts of the New York Harbor that people don't visit anymore. And she was saying that the most amazing thing to look at when you look at the skyline is that there's these brand new luxury condos that sit on top of, like, decaying, what are they called? Decaying docks.
Uh-huh.
Like, you can look at the city and actually see layers of history, very specifically looking back at you.
So when you're looking at this from the harbor, is this in New York City or is it in Brooklyn?
Either one.
Oh,
either one, because Brooklyn at this point is just an extension of Manhattan. The way I really started seeing the city as something special was I started reading about a man named Robert Moses, who was the city and parks commissioner of the whole city starting in the 20s and up until the 60s.
Of New York City.
Uh-huh. And he was an incredibly OCD man who was paranoid about congestion. And so his goal was to get the people out of the city. So he kept building these venues to push people out. He built most of the bridges that we know about.
Oh.
He built the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. He built most of the park. He invented the parkway.
Now, was he the person who created Central Park?
No, he did renovate Central Park, uh-huh, and Prospect Park, which means he, mm-hmm, tore down a lot of the original architecture of it and started over. He was just incredibly powerful, and the thing that he missed because he was sick was that the more avenues you create to get people out, the more people will come in, because, mm-hmm, it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. So he kept accidentally filling the city with more and more and more people. Mm-hmm. And without him, the city would look totally different. He invented the project building, and in his mind in the 30s and 40s, that was going to be utopia. It was going to be this brick square that, uh-huh, would house thousands and thousands of, oh, people. And we know now that it's practically inhumane, those buildings, but they still stand like Legos just along the,
yes,
shore.
Human warehousing.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
It is crazy. But a lot of those things that start off with some utopian dream,
yeah,
go to rot very quickly.
Go to rot.
Yes. I mean, the very word utopia, which means...
Which means...
No place.
Which means no place.
Right.
Which means perfect,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
It's this,
okay,
idea of perfection that will never exist there.
So you were there for a while,
mm-hmm,
and what was your work?
Oh, well, I worked at NBC.
Oh, what'd you do? So, writing for radio?
No. So I worked in television before I got into radio. I now work in radio.
What do you do in television?
So my last year of college, I interned at Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
And I was only with Weekend Update, which is their fake news show that they do in the middle of the show. And then when I graduated...
You were writing for that?
No, I was interning.
You were watching.
I was...
Learning.
I was editing.
Yes.
I was editing,
okay,
the jokes. And then when I finished college, I became an NBC page, which is one of the oldest programs at NBC. It's been there since 1933, and it's 50 post-college kids once a year are put into the building, and they're all rotated through different television shows,
mm-hmm,
until a spot at NBC is found for them.
Is it a guaranteed spot will be found or
no?
No,
you, uh-huh, have to. It's really funny because
so you still have to earn it.
You have to earn it, and it's every day you show up and you have to earn it. And once it's narrowed down to those 50 kids, it's you show up every day and you have to earn it against these other 49 incredibly talented young people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a page for a year, and then I worked at Rachel Maddow for a while, and then I got my job in DC working at public radio. So I moved on. But that was the other incredible part of my New York life, is that I got to go to work at Rockefeller Center every day.
And you really had some very astoundingly wonderful job experiences in New York.
Yeah,
I mean, Rachel Maddow and Saturday Night Live, that's hard to match anywhere.
I got to experience.
And you don't get anything like that in San Francisco.
No, because so there's something really momentous about these, like, these TV shows, these buildings, these streets that I understand that my New York experience is incredibly unique in that way. But even just walking into Rockefeller Center every day, it was this, like, this beautiful Art Deco building from the 30s one of my favorite stories about it is that the walls were, Diego Rivera was commissioned to come and paint the first floor, and he did, but he painted some he painted a couple communists, I think, on the wall, and the Rockefellers got mad.
Oh.
So they came in and they tore the walls
down. So how did they know they were communists?
Because it was Lenin.
Oh,
okay.
Okay.
And so even in these walls tell an incredible story.
A battle.
Of political strife.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. That is really interesting. So, but that's not actually Brooklyn.
No, that's Manhattan.
So talk about why you want to go back to Brooklyn and what would your love letters be? Because I have a thought.
Okay. I want to hear your thought, but I will tell you that I lived in two neighborhoods in Brooklyn. One was Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was originally an incredibly high-end Jewish neighborhood. And then there was the white flight and most of the Jews left at least that one pocket of Brooklyn. And it became a very, very low income African American community. Mm-hmm. And when I started living there, there was more and more students from Pratt that were starting to live in that neighborhood. But I got to live in this incredible neighborhood, where so many famous, hip hop stars have lived and so many famous, like, Shirley Chisholm was from there, and she was the first woman to run for president, and she was African American, so she's this 1-2 punch of a lady, and I was living on her block. And the neighborhood that I ended up moving to was Park Slope, where the part that I lived in was mostly Italian firefighters. Mm-hmm. And what I really loved about Brooklyn is how there's these pockets of ethnicities that it switches by the block, but depending on where you stand, you might as well be in a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood from the 1890s.
Uh-huh.
You might as well be in Italy from the 1940s. Like, there is.
So somehow this is serving your sense of foreverness.
Yeah.
I mean, I can feel just from the smile on your face. And again, I need a television moment because I wish people could see it. So it's not just geographical for you at all.
No, these moments in time and these places in time are frozen there that I don't know if you can see anywhere else in the country.
So it's a way of being. Oh, that is really so touching. I mean, if I'm feeling this right, it's just a way of getting to be everywhere over time at once.
Over time at once sounds exactly right.
It sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah.
And what a privilege that is. So what would you be writing love letters to Brooklyn pocket by pocket or overall or to the people who settled it or to Robert Moses or what?
It would be hard because it would be to the city blocks. It would be to different intersections. It would be to parks. It would be to people. It would be to neighborhoods. I remember when my parents dropped me off when I was 19. They're Greek immigrants from Virginia, so there was something I'm sure very nerve-wracking for them dropping off their daughter in this neighborhood. But next door to the restaurant that was downstairs from my house were two plastic chairs outside, and two Puerto Rican women, very, very old Puerto Rican women, were sitting in them, just like rocking back and forth and looking out. And my mom recognized that from Greece. She said, these are adults who sit outside every day and they see everything.
Mm-hmm.
They see everyone who walks on the street. They probably see everything that goes wrong. They see every kiss. They just see everything. And she felt really good about leaving me in a place where at least there were these watchdogs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I would write those two women a love letter.
Say, so they're like witnesses.
Yes.
In a big, important way.
Yes.
So you would write those two women a love letter. So here's what I'm thinking. I don't know if it would appeal to you, but given the kind of writer you are and given the way you see the world, if you wrote the 1,000 love letters to Brooklyn, wouldn't that be an exceptional book?
It would be a beautiful experience for me. My concern, and this is very honest, my concern is that so much has been written about that city and that borough that I don't know what I could say that hasn't been said.
Well, none of it's been said from your inside.
That's true.
So everything is new. And, you know, I think it's a mistake people make to think that it's been done already. So they do one of two things. Either, well, it's been done already, so I'm not going to bother. Or, well, it's never been done, so that means somehow there's not a market for it. But without considering a market for it, I just think that would be wonderful if, I mean, for you to do it for you, and then just mail them to yourself once a week, or once every 2 weeks, or whatever it is, or once a day. Mail them to yourself, and then you get to open them, and I will tell you that the you who wrote them is going to be different than the you who reads them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday you will have something that you will want to put into a collection. I think it would be huge.
Thank you.
I think it would be, I'd buy it.
Maybe I should send one to you.
You could do that about Brooklyn. I mean, really, if, because you have a connection with New York that's theatrically, historically important. And there are things that you know and could say, well, let me just say, I hope you do it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
I mean, starting with the two women, the first, for example, the two women, and those were the first people you saw when you got there, with a love letter to them, which could include why you were there and why your mother felt okay dropping you off there.
Yeah.
And that apparently, just from the look on your face, you felt a little safe knowing they were there also.
And probably they have no idea who I am.
Yes, and they have probably no idea the historical significance and the emotional significance they served.
Yeah.
I'm guessing they're no longer alive. Although it wasn't that long ago.
Well.
Maybe they were. Do you know their name?
No.
By now?
But I could go back. I mean, like, honestly, if they're still alive, they're there right now. So uh-huh. I could always just go back and look.
And probably somebody in the neighborhood knows who they are and knows their names. Oh, I think that would be a wonderful project. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for just talking about all this. And love of a city is a really wonderful thing and a wonderful kind of love letter.
Thank you.
There's a book out now about San Francisco, and it's quite a hit around here.
Okay.
Just about different neighborhoods. Oh, I think that's wonderful. Thank you, dear.
Thanks, Janet.
Well, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now. And please remember, if you think you need a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion. And in case you think you had to have a person to write a love letter to, you don't. The options are endless. So goodbye for now,